MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi there, I'm Jeff Stein.
I'm Michael Isikoff.
And I'm Karen Greenberg.
And welcome to another edition of the Spy Talk podcast. Well, pretty sleepy world, right?
Yeah.
God, is there anything going on beside Iran? Well, we're going to talk about Iran. We have to talk about it because there's a strong intelligence angle there for us by talk.
And we also have a great guest.
We have Joe Votel coming on, the former CENTCOM commander. So that's something to look forward to. And Mike, you're going to talk a little bit about him later on. But for the moment, there was this extraordinary New York Times piece that had a lot of insider reporting in it about how Trump got to the decision to attack Iran. And the gist of it is basically is that Netanyahu led him by the nose with all sorts of rosy predictions on how this would go down. But one of the interesting things for us was that the head of the CIA, John Ratcliffe, he didn't think it was such a great idea, did he, Mike?
Well, let's break this down a bit, because Netanyahu, as Maggie Haberman and Jonathan Swan reported in the New York Times this week, that in February, Netanyahu gives a big major briefing for the national security leadership and President Trump. And he says, now is the time that we could do this. We could take out the Ayatollah. We could decimate their missile production. And we could trigger an uprising that would eventually, that would lead to regime change. And this was the rosy eyed view that Netanyahu gave Trump. And what's extraordinary is the next day after Netanyahu does that briefing, the intel folks go back and ask all their people to evaluate what Netanyahu has just said. And John Ratcliffe, the director of the CIA, comes back and says the regime change scenario is, quote, farcical. And Secretary of State Rubio calls it bullshit. And we should point out that according to the piece, and one can presume that this has a lot to do with who provided some of the information for this piece, Vice President Vance argued somewhat forcefully against this operation, against the Iran operation, and Trump decided to do it anyway.
And we have to remember that Vance is very much the MAGA disciple. Right. No foreign wars. And so,
right. So one interpretation is, you know, Vance is leaking. Vance and his people are leaking to position himself if this doesn't turn out well, that he argued against it from the beginning. But, you know, to me, this is kind of, we've all drawn the parallels with the Iraq War. This is kind of the reverse of the Iraq War. In the Iraq War, the intel community provided faulty intelligence to the decision makers. Of course, that's what the Bush White House wanted to hear. But in this case, it's the opposite. The intel people provided what seems like pretty good intelligence, and the president chose to ignore it.
And as our Israeli correspondent, Yossi Melman, reported last week, Netanyahu is scapegoating the Mossad, saying, well, they said there'd be an uprising, and Mossad's people are coming back and saying, well, we didn't say it was going to be like, you know, the day after the bombing stopped, that there would be a popular uprising. And there was an issue of whether the CIA was going to back the Iranian Kurds to come in and start a second front and so on and so forth. So there's a lot of finger pointing going on. And it came out in that New York Times piece with Vance, if nothing else, sort of positioning himself for running for president on a no wars platform down the road.
But it's going to be hard to totally extract himself from this, because at the end of the day, you know, he told Trump, if you do this, I'll support you, which he has. And now he's headed to Pakistan to be the top U.S. negotiator with the Iranians. At this point, as we're taping this on Thursday, are the Iranians going to show up? Are they going to be in any mood or willingness to make any kind of deal that's acceptable?
But it is kind of interesting that, you know, you could take the story at face value, but it's also a sign of just a recognition that things are not going exactly well or exactly as they are planned, and sort of a sense of just, you know, of saying, wait, we were good soldiers, but this was not, you know. And so you kind of really have to wonder what this means for the future in terms of the, you know, tightness with the president. I mean, I think it's actually pretty interesting on that level. Sure.
Meanwhile, Karen.
Well, wait, before we get to meanwhile, can I just like one other point on Iran, because underscoring how little we really know about what has gone on. Trump made some really interesting and weird comments during the Easter egg roll at the White House, and I missed them. I just caught them, a little while ago. In which he said, we sent some guns. The group that was supposed to give, which I said would happen to my people, I said it, I called it exactly, we sent guns, a lot of guns. They were supposed to go to the people so they could fight back against these thugs. So I'm very upset with a certain group of people, and they're going to pay a big price for that. What is he talking about?
The Kurds? Is that what he's talking about?
Presumably.
That's the idea, but I mean, who knows?
You know, there was this back and forth where they were, we going to arm the Kurds or not? If this seems to be an indication that they did and somebody didn't do anything with the weapons we provided.
As we've known from 20 years in Iraq, things disappear in the supply chain.
But it's also, the reports are that the expectations that the Kurds would foment this kind of rebellion did not happen, that they were not taking. So,
not well thought out.
Yeah. Not. It's not just not well thought out. It wasn't well sourced.
Trump said, you know what happened? The people that they sent them to kept them because they said, what a beautiful gun. I think I'll keep it.
Yeah. Well, use against the Turks, maybe. Anyway.
I wonder if that's what the signals intelligence showed. Well,
to quote the immortal W.C. Fields, what a fine mess.
Yeah.
In any event, but listen. There's something else going on. There's lots of other things going on, despite the Iran mess, which is, Karen, at the Justice Department, the smoldering wreckage of the Justice Department.
Oh, my God.
Tell us what's going on there.
So the Office of Legal Counsel, which is the think tank, a part of the Department of Justice, which gets to, you know, issue memorandums about to president and the executive branch on what's legal, what's not legal that they're considering doing, issued a memo recently, which basically said that the Presidential Records Act, which was passed in 1978, is unconstitutional. Now that, in the context of a president who made it his business to hold on to records against, you know, the law, and has had this ongoing battle about it for all these years, is a very interesting moment. And what does that really mean in terms of how do we assess what's being done? How do we know what's being done? It's sort of one of the basic premises. It's not just about history. It's about understanding your country, to take away. So we'll see what happens. And now it's being challenged in court by the American Historical Association and American oversight. And so we'll see what happens.
Yeah, if there's no other responsibility of the government is to keep records, right? I mean, that's pretty basic. But we know that from the Mar-a-Lago case, Trump likes to keep records for himself. So this is going to be a recurring issue. Meanwhile, we have, even with the exit of Pam Bondi, we assume that this Antifa question and designating opponents as terrorists is still ongoing. It's like a machine. It's going to run on its own. And that's entirely secret. So I guess at some point they're going to arrest somebody who's just clearly a nonviolent protester and charge them with being a terrorist. And that's going to be a test case go up to the Supreme Court on the rocket docket.
Hey, Jeff, before we get to our guest, I don't think we could do a full podcast without mentioning our favorite character, Tulsi Gabbard.
Where's she been?
Very good question, because, you know, in that very detailed New York Times reporting about the intel briefs that Netanyahu gives and Radcliffe's there, Rubio's there, Hegseth's there, you know who's not there on these key decisions? About the intel about Iran, Tulsi Gabbard, nowhere to be found.
Well, we've seen reports that Trump's been asking around to his pals, who can I replace Tulsi with?
So, yeah, do you know some of the names?
I don't know any of the names, and I can't imagine who would want that job, even in the best of times, I might say.
I hear that there's a list emerging and that a lot of people, you know, want their name in it. But one of the things that I've seen some speculation about is Pam Bondi.
No
way.
I didn't believe it when I heard it. Yeah.
I got to say,
wow,
no way.
That's a movie. I'll tell you, that belongs in House of Cards. So. Anyway, before we get on to Joe Votel, I want you to talk about him a little bit, Mike. I must mention that according to South Korean intelligence, Kim Jong-un has selected his successor, and that is his 13-year-old daughter, Ju-I, if I'm pronouncing it correctly. She's 13. This is like Queen Isabella of Spain, you know, back in the day.
Ready for her bat mitzvah.
Well, in any event, so anyway, I just wanted to sneak that in. But tell us about Joe Votel, who's coming.
Yeah, this is actually a pretty cool and impressive guest we've got today. General Joe Votel was he's a graduate of the U.S. Military Academy. He served in the Pentagon for years with NATO. He was led a Rangers command in Afghanistan, and then he was appointed by Barack Obama to succeed Admiral McRaven as head of U.S. Special Operations Command, which put him in charge of all special forces, and, you know, then closed out his career as SOUTHCOM commander between 2016 and 2019. He led the war on ISIS and successfully dismantled ISIS. And that gives him pretty good street cred.
He's done it
to
all.
Evaluate what's been going on in the war in Iran.
And he has some very interesting insights and comments to make about that, as you will hear. So let's get right to it.
This is the new Weight Watchers, built for real life and real results, no matter what mode you're in. Maddie went all in for her big day and lost 33 pounds. Emily lost 85 pounds and hit her goal while still living her life.
Weight Watchers gave me the tools and I feel amazing.
Join the millions of members and lose weight with the number one doctor-recommended weight loss program. Lose more at WeightWatchers.com.
At 6 months, participants in a clinical trial of Weight Watchers program lost an average of 12 pounds.
General Joseph Votel, welcome to Spy Talk. It's really an honor to have you here. Thanks for spending the time with us. I must say that I'm getting a sense of deja vu all over again regarding Iran, and not just Iran. When I arrived in Saigon in 1968, that's how old I am, I got a briefing at MACV headquarters, and they said, we have the commies on the run. We have them on the ropes. Of course, a year later, at the end of my tour, we had them anything else but on the rope, because the political war had superseded the combat war. No matter how many victories we had, as a North Vietnamese general once said, it didn't matter. What matters was the outcome. Are you getting that feeling about, since you're with your experience in Afghanistan in particular, are you getting that feeling about Iran, that the leadership in the White House and Pentagon are saying, we're winning big time, but the politics on the ground says something else?
Well, first off, it's great to be with you all here. To some extent I am. I mean, we've put this ceasefire in place, and then of course we've seen both the Iranians and the U.S. government trying to you know, portray this as a victory. It's a ceasefire. It's a pause in the current fighting. So, you know, that would indicate we're not at an end state here. We're moving towards some kind of discussion that's taking place afterwards. But of course, a lot of the rhetoric out there is really, really giving the impression that, you know, that we've accomplished all of our strategic policy objectives here.
You worked for President Trump. Tell us about your interactions with him as a military leader, if you can.
Yeah. So I was the CENTCOM commander. I took over in 2016. And so that first year, that was under the Obama administration. And then the new president came in early 2017. Well, along with him came people like Jim Mattis, and of course Joe Dunford was the chairman at the time. So I had very high confidence in them and great relationships there. And you know, a lot of my work was with them. You know, the combatant commanders, the 4-star combatant commanders out there, CENTCOM, UCOM, PACOM, all these. We all have kind of quarterly interactions with the president. That's pretty normally scheduled. So we had you know, kind of those normal interactions with him. You know, he clearly, at the time, I think we thought of him as kind of a businessman. That's how we thought, okay, we knew it was going to be a different approach to it. I certainly did, to how he would do things. I think the big takeaway for me out of all that experience, are the differences in decision-making styles. You know, having worked with the Bush administration, with the Obama administration, and with the Trump administration, the national security process, I think, has the tendency to take on the characteristics of the decision maker, of the president. He designs it. He picks the process for himself. And, you know, I just say President Obama had a very deliberative process. There were lots of meetings. There was lots of discussion. And I think what he wanted is he wanted a lot of things sorted out, and then the options presented to him, and then he would decide. I think that's kind of how we went into the Trump administration, but I think President Trump's decision-making style is much more dominated by his own instincts, his own feelings about things, and the things that he wants to do. And so, what you end up having, I think, is a decision-making style that is, you know, kind of is more top-down into the process than it is bottom-up, like we had experienced before. And so, you know, that was different. That was different for us, because, you know,
some visions of being in the Oval Office with him must come up when you're talking about working for him. Can you remember a particular incident or episode with him where you walked out of the Oval Office and said, boy, this is really different? Can you remember what you talked about, or can you set the scene for us?
Let me tell you two stories. I want to tell a good one, and I'll do some contrary stuff. So, right. You know, I mentioned these quarterly things that we go up and do with the president. One of the times we went up there, you know, all the commanders are standing around there, and the president comes in and says, hey, do you guys want to go on a tour of the White House? And the president took us on a tour of the White House. I must say, it was pretty fantastic. He took us up. He showed us all kinds of things on the second floor there. He concluded in the Lincoln bedroom. And I thought, okay, that's pretty cool. He had a real sense of the place. He knew something about all the pieces of art. He knew something about every room, and it was a pretty darn good tour of the White House. And so, you know, that's part of the interaction with him in terms of some of this. The very first time he came to his very first trip as president in 2017 was to come down to CENTCOM headquarters in Tampa and visit us down there. And he did. And myself and General Tony Thomas, the SOCOM commander, was also collated kind of down, and we kind of did it over at my headquarters. And you know, I think the interaction, you know, we were prepared to, you know, I kind of talked to him about a variety of things. We had the campaign against ISIS going on at that particular time. And so, you know, we were prepared to talk to him about that. And I think what I learned very quickly in terms of this is you gotta be high level with him. You gotta be very quickly to the point with him. He's not a guy that's gonna sit through a lengthy discussion on things. He's instinctually gonna focus on things, and you know, and very quickly, you know, we, you know, as we kind of talked, we're talking about what we were trying to do in Iraq and in Syria. We very quickly got back to a discussion about we should have taken the oil, kind of thing. So, you know, he talked
to you about taking the oil.
Yeah, his reference.
That set you back on your heels a little bit?
Well, it was his reference point, I think, to this. So I think it was, you know, I won't say it really set me back on my heels, but it was an insight into how he is thinking about the region and how he kind of processes information and how he's looking to have information presented to him. So.
Well, I would think that you would, when he left the room, you would have turned to each other and said, wow, this guy is he's a different bird. He's talking about taking the oil. How did that go down with you guys?
Well, I think it was more of a reference to kind of our previous activities in the Middle East here when we were in Iraq the last time. And I think that was kind of what he was referring to. I frankly, none of us took that as a particular serious thing, and it wasn't a direction to us in terms of that. It was kind of a comment that he made, but it was an insight into how he was kind of thinking about the region. I think we found it all interesting and then kind of went on and continued to do what we were being directed to do in the Middle East. So,
General, you were a CENTCOM commander between 2016 and 2019. I'm assuming that you must have war game scenarios of a conflict with Iran multiple times during those years. And yet, you know, one of the takeaways people have had from the current conflict is the degree to which it does appear that U.S. officials were surprised that the Iranians shut down the strait and were able to do so with ease, and also surprised that they fired at our Gulf allies, including Saudi Arabia. Were you surprised, and were these scenarios that you dealt with when you were, you know, doing wargaming potential conflicts with Iran when you were CENTCOM commander?
No, these were things that we expected to happen. I think we certainly expected that they would launch attacks at our bases and potentially at the partners that were supporting us across the region. I think we knew that. And of course, we know that they have the kind of the geographical advantage over the Straits of Hormuz, and that, you know, by virtue of how narrow it is and how it can be dominated, it's very, very easy to close. And then, of course, we, you know, one of the things I experienced early on in my time at CENTCOM was we were, you know, a lot of our ships that were passing in and out of the Gulf were always kind of being harassed by kind of the small boats from Iran. So we'd seen that. We knew that they were going to do something like this. And I think all of our plans anticipated that this would be something that would happen. I'm surprised.
But look, I mean, it does appear they've got this chokehold on the world economy right now, which does raise, if this was a scenario that was anticipated, what does that say about the initial decision by the president to launch this war in the first place?
Well, you know, the president is the decision maker, and he made the decision to do this. I mean, the fact is, I think he put more stock in perhaps, you know, maybe the advice that he was getting from, you know, Prime Minister Netanyahu and his own personal instincts about how this would go down. Maybe he was confident based on our activities in Venezuela and the very quick success that we had there with very little cost to ourselves in terms of that. Maybe that was what he was thinking was going to happen. I can't speak exactly for him in terms of that, but what I can say is I think what Iran has done is about what we would expect them to do. And I think people lose sight of the fact that this is existential to the regime, and they are going to do everything they can to remain in power. And
so if if you were in the, I want to talk about the extraordinary reporting that the New York Times had this week about the briefing Netanyahu gave the president and the reaction from the intelligence and military community. But I mean, if you were in the room when this was being discussed, would you have spoken up more forcefully than perhaps your former colleague General Kane did about the dangers of launching a war of this kind and the reaction that the Iranians might have?
Well, I'm not so sure I can put myself in that position to do that. I mean, I think the responsibility for commanders is to lay out the options and then lay out the ramifications of those options. And you know, there's an ongoing debate in the National Security Council about, you know, not in the national security process, about, you know, best military advice and how we provide that to our civilian leaders. So, you know, I think, you know, my expectation would be that the Department of Defense would go in, you know, certainly and lay this out in much greater detail. So it isn't just the chairman's responsibility, it's also the secretary's responsibility, I think, to make sure that all of the risks are laid out in terms of this. So
does it appear to you that was done in this case?
Well, I think there, you know, I've read the article that you read as well, and you know, there's not much else out there on it, and appears to be somewhat credible article in terms of you know, the reporting on it. And so you know, it sure sounds like there was, at least in the initial discussions, there was some reservation shared about some of the assessments that were being provided to us by the Israeli leadership, particularly in terms of, you know, the regime collapsing or the population rising up and our ability to actually achieve that. I think that was raised. But again, I think the president, based on his decision-making style, I think arrived at an instinctual decision of where he was. And that may have, you know, tamped down on people, you know, providing more direct, you know, feedback to them.
Yeah, I have a question about how you and how you think the military is perceiving the isolation of the United States. I mean, it seems like the United States is going to go this alone in terms of the military part of it, that the discussions with the Secretary General of NATO did not go well. Trump has made it clear that he is willing to push NATO aside and separate from it. NATO has been important to the United States in the past, in Afghanistan, as you know, and elsewhere. And so do you think that there's a sense in the military that the United States is the best, they can handle everything by themselves, they don't need to have a larger cadre of partners? Or do you really think this is a game changer in terms of the vulnerabilities of the United States? And you, in addition to your thoughts, I've been interested in what you think you've heard from the military and how they feel about this sort of direction that the United States military...
When I talk to military colleagues, they still talk about the importance of partnerships. They still talk about the value of building relationships with our partners in the Middle East or in Europe or in the Pacific or wherever it happens to be. So I think that is still a very, very important part of our processes. And you know, our doctrine, the way that we have kind of gone to war, the things that we have done in the past, all reinforce the idea that we want to do things through kind of coalition operations. That we are better when we go with others to do these things. It, you know, it gives us more capability, it gives us more legitimacy. It helps us, you know, explain better the things that we are trying to accomplish. So I think that is still very strong within the uniform military. I'll just say that. That's my impression. I personally am concerned about kind of the go-it-alone approach here on this. And, you know, I'm like everybody, I paid attention to, you know, the NATO Secretary General being here in the last couple of days and watching all of that. And, you know, if we didn't have a NATO, we would probably try to create one, frankly. I mean, it's been important. And I've served in a NATO headquarters. I understand the frustration that comes along with coalition operations, and, you know, the challenges with consensus in a big headquarters like that, and that it is sometimes slow moving. But in the end, it really is quite powerful when you are able to bring so many partners together around an issue. I served during the Bosnia timeframe in a NATO headquarters, and it was absolutely essential. It was painful, but it was essential to get everybody aligned and moving forward on that particular mission set. So I think one of the mistakes we did make in this situation is we did not reach out to our partners. We did not consult with people beforehand and prepare them for what we were going to do and the potential consequences that that may involve them down the line, whether it's the consequences of the our actions or whether it's the need that we may have some other, you know, military requirements that, you know, we may ask them to assist with. And to me, that's different, particularly at this scale. I mean, we can do things like Venezuela or Osama bin Laden. We can do those kind of things by ourselves. But when we're at scale like this, and the things that we are doing are going to have impacts on international markets and other things, and stability across a region, in those cases, I think we have a responsibility to focus on our partners and to make sure we've built the coalition and we've communicated and we've brought people along in a way that that, you know, supports our mission. I think it's hurting us at this particular point, frankly, on this. And so some effort up front would have gone a long way here.
Do you think that any of the military heads could have some sway over the White House on this? Or do you think it's really, I mean, you know, is there something in the works? Is there some kind of voice? Is there some kind of pressure that could be exerted, or it's just not going to happen?
Well, I don't know that, you know, I don't know that it's reasonable to think somebody is going to just show up at the White House and say, hey, listen, we ought to really bring our coal. Yeah. I think what you'll continue to see is that our military, you know, senior military, you know, officers will continue to involve their partners in things wherever they can and bring them into our planning, bring them into our exercises and, you know, into our contingencies and stuff like that. And, you know, whether it's in the Pacific or whether it's in Europe or, you know, in the Middle East, I think it's going to be by example is how I think we're going to do it.
General, there was some fear rising over Trump's ultimatums to the Iranians that he might actually reach for nuclear weapons to solve this issue. Can you guess how the military command would have reacted to President Trump saying, I want to drop a couple of tactical nukes on Iran to break this impasse?
I have a lot of confidence and trust in the military leadership that we have out there, and I think they're good men and women. They're very, very experienced.
And yet, you had studied the Iran problem for decades. Personally, and, you know, among your peers, and recognize the problem in the Hormuz Strait and the energy cutoff and all that. And yet, let me use a crude term here, y'all rolled over, or the current leadership rolled over on Trump when he decided to go into Iran, just being led by the nose, if you might say, by Benjamin Netanyahu. So what makes you confident that the military would stand up to Trump on nuclear weapons? Or what do you see happening? What would happen?
Well, I think there would be, you know, certainly these things are discussed in the tank with the Joint Chiefs of Staff. I'm certain they would have some discussions about this, and, you know,
it would leak. Are you saying?
Well, I don't know. No, I wouldn't say it was a leak. I don't think that helps anybody by leaking stuff here. And I think the leadership would through the chairman, you know, communicate the concerns about those types of things. Again, you know, the military has a process by which it goes through all of this and considers the leaders do this. And I can't tell you exactly how they would do this. What I can tell you is that I'm confident in the values, and I'm confident in the experience, and I'm confident in the judgment of the military leaders that are in place right now, that they are going to represent us, not just the institution, but they're going to represent the country in the very best way they can. And they are bound by law, and they are bound by their own values in this. And
well,
I think they're...
General, on that score, let's leave aside nuclear weapons for a moment. We've all read President Trump's, posts on Truth Social, bombing them back to the Stone Ages, attacking power plants and bridges. Now, when you were CENTCOM commander and you were ordering airstrikes on ISIS, you know, my understanding is each and every one of those had to be vetted by some JAG officer to ensure that this was a primarily military target rather than civilian target. How can you possibly square what Trump was threatening to do and is still threatening to do? He had another post last night on Truth Social with the very rigorous process that you had to go through and the military still has to go through before approving strikes.
Well, you know, I guess my experience on this is, you know, in 2016, 2019, tweeting wasn't quite as prominent as it is today. So, you know, frankly, when you saw things in tweets, my instinct was to go back to regular order here. There's a way that orders and instructions are passed through the Pentagon down to the combatant commanders and subsequently out to our forces, and to rely on those processes. So I said more simply, tweets are tweets. They're not, they don't necessarily, at least they didn't at my time, they didn't constitute an order. Even though sometimes we have a tendency to certainly appreciate what the president, whoever is tweeting, whatever decision maker is tweeting, is, you know, there's certainly some intent in there that they're conveying in terms of this. So, I mean, that I guess is the first point. And Michael, I forget the next thing, part of the question.
Well, I'm just saying, look, I mean, I don't see how you could square bombing them back to the Stone Ages.
Yeah, I'm with you.
Respect for international law and civilian protections that you were required to do as CENTCOM commander.
Well, yeah, I would agree with you. The president's tweet on bombing back to civilization is a shocking one. I mean, we wouldn't say that when we had unconditional surrender of Germany or Japan. We preserved the emperor in place because we had appreciation for the cultural aspect of the role that he played in Japan. So, you know, it's a shocking statement, I think, to come from the president of the United States. But I think what we also recognize is that the president has a very unique way of communicating, and that he uses that forum to message and to put pressure on people and things like that. And so there is a certain nuance, I think, that comes in. I'm not excusing it. I don't support it. I don't like that kind of stuff. I think it's unnecessary. I think it's unhelpful. I think this whole campaign would have been much better if we'd had a more disciplined, strategic communications plan that kept us aligned and had a much more cohesive message to it.
Speaking of alignment, we have to take a break for just a second. We'll be back in a second.
And we're back. We're back with General Votel. And just to follow up on the discussion we were just having, General, if you were ordered as CENTCOM commander to bomb power plants and bridges that would have that kind of a impact on civilian infrastructure, would you carry out that order?
We would execute the process that we have for selecting targets, and that is we go back and we look particularly at these dual use targets, and we'd look at the military value of these targets, and then we would make determinations about whether these things that are dual use, and if they are principally benefiting the military, or if they're what the benefit of those of striking those targets and the effect that it has, and we'd look very, very closely at that. And if there was concerns about that, I would certainly take the time to talk to the secretary and the leadership about that.
And if the secretary said, "I don't care, the president wants this, do it anyway," what would you do?
Well, then, if that's the case, if at that time I don't agree with that, then my option is to step aside.
And you would do that if you got such an order as the president was reflecting in these truth social.
Yeah, I think that's the obligation of any officer, when any commander, when he or she can no longer, conduct execute the orders that are being passed to them because in his or her estimation they're illegal. Then that's what you must do.
So the nuclear option aside, we've also seen, breaking of and challenges to international law generally, in terms of bombing civilians, civilian targets, disregard for civilians. And I think in many ways that is also in the category of what so many in the military are trained to not violate, and that feel very strongly about it. So given that that seems to be in the mix in terms of the orders that have come and could come, do you see resignations in powerful positions as something that could be happening in this context?
I don't know. I'm not sure I can answer that question, get into the minds of those who are dealing with this, but I think this is something every senior leader thinks about, and how he or she are going to react in a particular situation. So, again, I think it's I don't know that that's going to happen, but I certainly can't dismiss it. And I have high confidence in our military uniform military leaders, and I think they're people of high value, and I think they will make the right decisions when the time comes.
I want to turn just to something a little bit more specific to the conflict.
And I thought you were going to say easier.
Yes, of course.
Nothing's easy about this.
So Hezbollah, the issue of Hezbollah, which is both baked into the process in terms of Israel's mindset, but not baked into the process in terms of the ceasefire agreement, right? And also, the way in which the United States seems to be aligning this and sort of saying, well, it's not part of it, but it is part of it because we defer to Israel. What do you, just thinking about this from a military point of view, what do you think about this idea of trying to eradicate, defang, however you want to describe it, Hezbollah as part of this process? And is there a constructive way to go forward with that rather than this sort of, gray area that we've constructed?
Yeah, I think there is. And I think we've missed an opportunity here. And I'll just caveat my comments here by saying I have great affinity for Lebanon. The president, President Aoun, was the chief of defense when I was a CENTCOM commander. He and I are personal friends. I think he's a very good and decent man. And I think the Lebanese people deserve an opportunity here. I wish after he had been put in position that we had stepped forward and helped the Lebanese armed forces and the Lebanese government get into a better position where they could actually begin to address some of the challenges, particularly those south of Latani. I think that would have been helpful. That was our opportunity, I think, to do this. Last year after he got in, by all accounts, I think he's a good man. The Lebanese forces are small, but they've done well as they penetrate deeper down below the Latani in the areas where Hezbollah is, you know, has been so well established down there, it becomes much more difficult. And those are the places where we need to help them. I'm not talking about U.S. troops on the ground. I'm talking about equipment. I'm talking about funding. I'm talking about the political support that comes along with doing that, about helping provide them the time. Rather than some artificial timeline of a realistic timeline for what it's going to take to do that. The United States should have done that, in my view. And we did not set our partner up for great success. So that's kind of how I think about that. You know, Hezbollah is, you know, is both a military force and a political ideology as well. It will be difficult to get rid of the political ideology. Long term, we can certainly do a lot to diminish and dismantle the Lebanese Hezbollah military capability. I think a lot has been done to date, but again, it's substantial, but it's not absolute, and so there still are going to be missiles, and there's a lot there. I mean, they've had decades to build this up.
General, I want to ask you about how do we get out of this, but before I do that, I have to ask you an intelligence question. What do you think about this stuff that John Ratcliffe has talked about with ghost murmur, that we can hear a heartbeat from 40 miles away? What do you think of that?
Having been the JSOC commander and the SOCOM commander and having worked closely with the intelligence community, I have a pretty high regard for their capabilities. I don't know about the specific one you're referencing there, but I do think they have the ability to do a lot and to help us a lot. And I think what we've seen just this last weekend with this recovery of 44 Bravo, the weapon system officer off that F-15, I think should give us very high confidence in the extraordinary intelligence capabilities that the United States has.
Well, it seemed to defy the laws of physics, but we'll revisit that some other time.
I didn't do that great in physics, so it's not not
me neither.
Not that difficult for me to get over the hurdle.
So you've been a unit commander. You parachuted into Afghanistan at the head of a 200 men paratroopers. You've been in Bosnia. You've been a strategic commander. You've been an advisor to the president, a CENTCOM commander. So what would you be telling President Trump today on how to get out of this mess alive, as it were?
Well, I think we have to be resolute, and we have to be firm now. We are where we are, and as we get to this negotiation process, I think we've got to go in it, you know, not with just with the idea of, you know, compromising where we have to, but also to kind of stick to a point here where we can come out of this with something that is better than when we came in, which, you know, I guess would be, you know, a more stable region, and Iran is less of a threat to its neighbors and to us down the line, and the military component of that is to be prepared to back that up.
So you mean that more military force?
I didn't say more military
may
force.
Have to be applied.
We need to, if we, again, Jeff, we are where we are today. We've already talked about the decision to do this, about whether it was a good one or a bad one. We're past that. We're here right now, and I think for us, my view is that I think, you know, if for us to just depart and leave this, I think would leave the region in a really bad way. I think it would seriously affect our relationships. It would, you know, have economic impacts. It would have security impacts for us, and it would leave Iran in kind of an emboldened position. So I think, given where we are today, I think we have to stay strong. We have to be able to be willing to back up our negotiation process with a credible military threat here.
Well, President Trump says we won. So is that kind of a solution here for him to just say, well, we won big time and walk away?
Well, again, that's his decision to make. And I guess it would be one of the options he could make is saying, listen, we've done what we need to do. We've done enough damage here. The regime is set back enough and we can step out of this. That's one option. My feeling on that is I think it would leave us in a very bad, we'd leave our partners in the region in a very bad place as a result of this. And there'd be problems that have to be sorted out and, you know, might see us coming back sometime in the future, or it might revisit us in ways that we haven't even anticipated right now. So, you know, leaving a bad situation doesn't necessarily mean it's going to get better just by leaving it. So, that's certainly an option the president has here, and one that I'm sure he would consider along with others. But I think there's some real drawbacks to that.
So one key goal, or perhaps the key goal that the president has set, is to make sure Iran never has a nuclear weapon. And that leads to the storehouse of enriched uranium that they've already got. Now, before you were CENTCOM commander, you were special operations commander. Is extracting the enriched uranium from the sites where they've got it, is that a job that special forces could pull off and would be advisable for them to be directed to do?
Yeah, I think that is a mission that, you know, that the, I would just, let me just broaden it a little bit. The U.S.
is it a doable mission?
It is a doable mission, but it is. And let's define doable here. Can we do that? We certainly can. We can get our whatever the special operations capability we need. We can bring the other conventional forces together around this. It's a significant operation. It's going to take time. It's likely that there's going to be casualties associated with this. We've got to be able to put people on the ground. We've got to be able to protect them. We've got to be able to sustain them. We've got to be able to get all of that out. We've got to be able to bring in the equipment to dig down and recover this stuff, maybe at multiple sites. So it's a significant operation. So I think, you know, yeah, we can do a lot. We can do a lot. I have no doubt the military can put together a plan to do this. The question will be, is our political leadership ready to accept the ramifications, the risks that come along with this? And that would be the responsibility, at least from a you know, a senior commander level, to explain those types of ramifications, those types of risks, so that our civilian leaders can make an informed decision about that.
So you said two things there. You said it would take time and there will be casualties. And that's the very, knowing the answer, how much time, how many casualties approximately defines what the political risks would be for the president. Can you give us some idea of what you're talking about when you say it would take time, how long, and what would be the risk of casualties and how high?
Well, I think if doing it in a situation like we see right now, where as we talked about this, I would have envisioned when we first started talking about this, it was in a time before we had a ceasefire. So I think what we have to recognize is that the Iranians, first of all, have a vote in this. And despite the significant damage that's been done, they still retain some missile and drone capabilities. And it's likely that they would try to come after forces to make it very, very difficult for us to do that mission. And in the process of doing that, we have to recognize that there's a high likelihood that could lead to U.S. casualties on the ground in Iran. And so that's about what I can. I can't say there's going to be a dozen. I can't say there's going to be 100. I can just say, hey, there's going to be a reaction here, and they're going to employ capabilities that can kill and wound Americans on the ground. And we have to recognize that. I can't tell you what the casualty numbers are going to be, but in terms of the time, I mean, these are materials that are, you know, deeply buried underground. And they've now been bombed, as from our bombings of last summer, and perhaps some additional things that we've done since. So it's going to take some time to dig down in that. This is a very demanding environment for operators to go down into. They're underground. There's challenges with, you know, with just being able to breathe. There's challenges with you know, with communications, there's all kinds of things underground. I mean, it's just really, really, really challenging environment in which to operate. So, you know, this isn't going to be a quick in and out in the course of a period of darkness. It's going to take days and maybe into weeks to try to do this. And it's why I think the best way of doing this would be as part of a negotiation process. The best way to do this would be to go in as part of the International Atomic Energy Agency, you know, under their auspices. So they take control of this, or we can take control of it. It doesn't really matter. And it doesn't necessarily have to be us, but a military force can come in and provide the military support that they need while they bring in some experts. I mean, that's another option to this. And that's one, I think, you know, there's risk associated with that as well. But, you know, I think when you begin to lay out the risks with the different options, then you can begin to see where, you know, things, our political leaders can begin to make decisions that are, you know, maybe in our better interest.
So one of the things you're sort of suggesting is that the preparation to do this responsibly, if we were, you know, to extract this responsibly, could take quite a significant amount of time. I mean, do you get the sense that there's already some sense of, you know, tactical way to do this? Or this is really, we're starting from scratch or starting near the beginning?
I think one thing the U.S. military does extraordinarily well is plan and plan for contingencies. And so I think I would be very surprised if we had not been anticipating in a position where we could, you know, at least be able to identify what it would be required if we were asked to go in and do this with military resources only. So I have very high confidence in the ability for us to plan and pull together the things. But again, this is a big operation. So we're going to do this. You know, this is a big operation. We're going to have airplanes over. Yeah. It's not just soft. It isn't just some little soft team on the ground.
This is not like SEAL Team 6, yeah, you know, this going is, in. This is huge. This is hundreds.
You're going to have a big security island run. You're going to have air caps up over it. We're going to reposition ships in such a way that we can, you know, cover potential threats. We're going to do a whole bunch of things.
Might have to parachute make sure in successful. Bulldozers.
Well, we're going to have to, you know, be able to land things. We're going to have to be able to take 1,000 pounds of pretty noxious material out of the country. So these are big things. Yeah.
As we saw in the rescue of the weapons officer from the F-15, things go wrong. They almost always go wrong. Venezuela was a big, big exception. Here we had a plane that got stuck in the sand.
But Jeff, we were ready for that.
Two planes.
They responded.
That's right.
There
was a great backup plan.
There was a contingency. There was a way to do it. So
yeah, but you multiply that by 1,000, you know, with troops going in and heavy equipment, et cetera, et cetera. I agree with you that some contingency involving the IAEA seems like a much more possibly fruitful path to take.
Yeah.
Again, if the Iranians can cooperate with that. We'll see. Anyway, General, thanks so much for coming on our show. We're honored to have you here to discuss this happy prospect.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate the wire brushing here.
No, I love what you said about the
wire brushing.
No. I love what you said about the president picks the process. I just think that's
it's very important. And, you know,
really
so
important. It's really good.
You know, and that's one thing I think, you know, I still have an opportunity to talk to a lot of leaders, and I do remind them of that. You know, hey, it's not their job to comport to us. It's our job to comport to the civilian leaders. That's the underlying principle of our, you know, kind of our military and service of the nation. So we've got to recognize that.
Yikes.
Well, thanks again, General.
Okay.
We'll might ask you to come back again at another crossroads in this war.
I look forward to it. Good to see all of you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, do check out the spytalk.co news site on Substack, where we offer steady diet of scoops and original analyses from the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk and you'll quickly find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai and expertly edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media. That's it. See you around. I'm Jeff Stein.
I'm Michael Isikoff.
I'm Karen Greenberg.
Thanks for listening.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to SpyTalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MSW Media.